extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from Kansas City. I am Andrew Weeby with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Matt Doyle. Announcement time. This is a no-banter show. No time to waste. No messing around, all right? We got big stuff coming up here. We have big breaking news in Major League Soccer. Thierry Henry has stepped down as the head coach of CF de Montreal. We will give you the details in just 1 second, but you need to know that Kobe Jones and Portland Timbers manager Gio Savarese are coming up on this show. And did you know that the U.S. in 1995 at Copa America beat Argentina 3-0 to win their group? You might not.
I knew. Doyle did.
Well, Kobe was on that field. Kobe did it. Kobe can tell you the incredible story of that U.S. team and much, much more. We're going to chat with him in just a little bit. We're also going to talk Olympic qualifying. The prelim rosters are out. Efra Alvarez is on Mexico and U.S. Why is that? We'll discuss. And, of course, we want you to check out the call-up. They have Justin Morrow on their newest episode. That is a must-listen. Doyle's got his questions for the Eastern Conference at MLSsoccer.com. I've got a breakdown of the pressure meter on all the new head coaches in the league at MLSsoccer.com. And Greg Seltzer's got the top 10 breakout player candidates. We will get to the producer Anders reminder of the day. But first, we have to talk Thierry. And we have to, again on this show, point out that humanity trumps soccer, right? I mean, if you read Thierry's statement in leaving Club de Foot Montreal, it's not about the competition side. It's not about the league. It's not about his aspirations as a manager. It's about his life. It's about his children. It's about his family. It's about a pandemic that has robbed so much from all of us. It is about saying I have to do what's right for me. And you know what? I'm sitting here in a basement in Kansas City. I understand, man. Thierry, loved having you in this league. Would have loved to have you here still. But we completely get it. Go do what's right for you and your family.
And I think you see with Henry, listen, we hope first off, as you said, everything's okay with his family and he's able to get back to them and be comfortable and be happy again. And then the other is, you know, it's unfortunate him leaving this league now, but he has been a great ambassador for MLS as a player. And then when he left and went back to Europe, and so he'll continue to do that. So, you know, Thierry Henry is always going to be involved and around Major League Soccer because he has been now for almost 10 years. And he'll continue to do that in Europe. You'd think, and if he can coach and manage there, he can continue to kind of like push that, which is, we talked about Pano on the last show and Patrick Vieira and Jesse Marsh and what guys are doing over there in Tierra, and we will continue to be a part of that.
Yeah, and I'll be a helicopter fan of any team that Thierry Henry ends up managing in be it England or France or wherever.
Or in Catalonia.
I don't think that's going to happen. Not yet, anyway. But he, like you said, David, like MLS was better off for having him here, both as a player and a coach. It is entirely understandable that he has decided to go, you know, back home at this point. Because, I mean, I've seen my mom once in the past 14 months. And I'm a 44-year-old man, and it's brutal. And like, I can't imagine trying to raise kids and not being able to see that your kids, your wife, it's been a tough year. So bon voyage, Thierry Henry, and thank you for being here. For Montreal, this is tough. This is yet another reset, right? Because it seems like a lot of the players they brought in over the past 6-8 months were guys who Henry wanted to work with. Mason Toy, Georgi Mihailovic, a bunch of the guys that they signed from South America as well. Montreal was a club that, like, they are almost constantly in a state of flux. And what has to happen now is they have to find some stability. And they thought they were going to have that with Henry for a good long while. And they were, you know, the pandemic kind of stole that from them. And now they have to find it, be it from the front office or from whoever the new manager is.
And I agree with Doyle. And I think two things. One, you want some level of continuity. We know Patrice Bernier stepped away from that first team this week, and that's one of the names you'd think would be in there. And they've added Lawrence Simon, but we brought up Wilfred Nancé, I think on the last show or two shows ago when we talked about Bournemouth. He's been in this club for 6 or 7 years. Everyone you talk to around Montreal thinks of him highly. And we also have to say this, and we're going to talk to Kobe Jones a little bit later about this, but we're talking about anti-racism and changing this league and changing the world. There was no black coaches appointed in this offseason. That's not on Montreal specifically, but we have to talk about that. And there has to be given opportunity and space for people who are overqualified, qualified, and then whatever else in between, because it's soccer and nothing really makes sense in most of these job titles. Wilfred Nancé, from everyone that's worked with him and worked around him, says he deserves this opportunity. And so I hope Montreal sees it the same way.
It sounds like they probably will. And that's where that stability comes from. And you mentioned that for the Impact Oil. That's, I think, sort of the saving grace here, is that they did go out and you have Renard, who's sort of running the player side. He's still there. Continuity there. He had to be on board with those signings as well. Nancé, as you said, Dave, is part of this staff that's evaluating him and has so much experience inside the organization from academy on up. I mean, you have someone who gets what you want to be. You have someone who understands the stability and the plan that the Impact, say it to Montreal. It's going to take me so long to break that habit. That's a decade-long habit, are looking for. So I think he can have those strings pulled together. He's been in that locker room. He's been a part of the staff. If that's who they go with, I think they will have stability. But we will see with CFT Montreal. All right. Producer Andre's reminder of the day before we get to Kobe. Get out the checkbook and say your goodbyes. I haven't read this, so I don't know what that cryptic sentence means. Daryl DK is on the board for Barnsley. Ah, yes, he scored. Our guy scored. I've been firing up ESPN Plus to watch Barnsley games, but somehow I missed this one, Dave. I missed the goal. I saw like the bully ball and the physical play and the moments and the almost, but I didn't get the goal. So tell me about the goal. And this is the question from Daniel Khalili. He says, what do you think Daryl DK's future holds? Will he come back to MLS, or is this going to be permanent for him overseas?
So for the goal, it's a nice finish. He pulls off to the right side after a corner kick and a knockout. But it is very championship. It is volleyball until it lands at his feet. And then he gets an opportunity to put it in. And you mentioned he's played now, I think, four times.
That's not true. Wait a minute. What? No, that's not true. All right, so first of all, it was a cleared corner. And then Barnsley turns around and plays it back in really quickly. And then that was a nice little reverse pass from whoever the Barnsley winger was. No, that was a nice bit of play.
I'm not complaining about that.
No, you just called it volleyball until it lands at his feet. It was not that. It was really well done by the Barnsley winger to see the run that Daryl was making. And it was a really good Predators run in the box. Like, he understood where the defense was going, and he understood where the pass reversal was going to be. He held himself onside, and the pass was perfect. So, he's been mostly playing just as a target man. They've just been launching 35 long balls at his head every time he is out there, and it's kind of horrible to see because he's so much more than that as a player. And this was a moment where he actually got to show that he could be more than that as a player, that he has good sense in the box and that he makes good runs and he has good feet. Please continue, David.
Yeah, but no, who set? Who had this set? Who set the ball?
So I look forward to Doyle's the top 10 teams in the Championship Eastern Conference and what they need to fix going into next year on MLSsoccer.com. And the wingers on Nottingham Forest.
We didn't answer the question.
But I was going to say, no, to Doyle's point, though, it has not been pretty to watch with this team. I still think Daryl DK has shown the things he does well are effective at that level, at least, if not more. And he has been a central force to what Barnsley's wanted to do for a 20-year-old 3 weeks into moving to a new country and playing for a new team. So I actually think so far, and to Anders' point, it's been successful. And any other team around the world can look at that and say, this is a guy who can scale into what we do. And there's still a ton of room for growth. So I think it's gone really well for him. And I think on the flip side as well, Orlando, because they either want him in form coming into their season or a potential major sell that they can make. And they've made another signing to fill in that attacking core as well if he does leave. And so it's been a positive so far, I think, for all accounts.
Doyle, I just want a yes or no answer here. Will Daryl DK come back to MLS?
No.
In May, I believe.
No, I think somebody's going to hit. I don't know if they're going to, they're not going to hit a $20 million buyout clause, but I think somebody's going to make Orlando City an offer they can't refuse. And to David's point about DK doing really, really well, you're not necessarily going to see it in the goal scoring numbers or the passing numbers, because they are playing a really regressive style of soccer. It's like straight up early 90s long ball.
I haven't seen this many goal kicks taken.
Oh my God, dude, it's brutal. But he's so good in those situations that he attracts two or three defenders. So even if he's not winning those headers, he's just, his presence out there is putting his team into situations where they have a numbers up situation to win the second ball. And that's allowed them, frankly, to get into the final third repeatedly in good spots, which I'm not going to claim to have watched a single minute of Barnsley before Daryl DK got there, but apparently they were really struggling with that in the first half of the season. So just by having this route one available, he has made this team better, even if his passing numbers are ugly and his, you know, goal scoring numbers are not going to, like, he's not going to win the golden boot there just because of the way he's being used. He has actually changed the complexion of his team, which is great. I just hope that someone else notices, a team that plays actual soccer notices and brings him there, because he is so much more than a guy who you just, you know, punt it 60 yards towards his head and hope that he can win it. Like, he could be a lot more than that. But the fact that he is doing that, like, really, really known for that, is encouraging.
Feels like he could be a good outside hitter. No, sorry, I'll stop with the volleyball references here at this point. The whole time I'm thinking things, damn, stupid things in my head. Before we get to Kobe Jones, I do just want to hit the biggest signing in MLS in sort of the interim between shows here. I think that's Inter Miami going out and getting their defensive midfielder from Brazil. Or should I say Chris Henderson going out and getting his long-term Brazilian midfield crush, Gregor, from Bahia, who we know pretty well. What, Freddie Adu was at Bahia for a while? Was it Rodney Wallace at Bahia for a hot second?
No, I think Rodney Wallace was at Sport. Just saying.
Okay, good point. Good point. This is a guy that Chris Henderson was scouting in the process that eventually netted Jao Paulo for the Sounders. This was apparently their original target. He's been the captain of Bahia. He's, all intents and purposes, a really, really good player. TAM deal here. If you go look at the announcement from Inter Miami on this signing, all the mentions are Brazilians saying, take care of our boy. Like, clearly, he is beloved at his club. But, Dave, you and I were talking about this. It feels like the perfect sort of glue signing that makes everybody else better. And if you look at elite MLS teams over the last, you know, basically forever, they have a good defensive midfielder. They have an anchor.
Absolutely. 26 years old, so a guy you think will be there for a while that you can build that midfield around. And Pizarro, of course, also young, who can be in that midfield. And as you said, Chris Henderson wanted him in Seattle on a DP deal. Now he gets him in Inter Miami on a TAM deal. So it's great business for them. It's the player he wants, ID'd. And you see him slot in on your depth chart, and you're already thinking he can make everyone better. I don't know how Blaise Matuidi fits into this whole thing. And I think that's part of what's tough is you've got a group that put together a team, and then 2 months later, you've got a new group trying to put together a whole new team. And so there's going to be some awkward spots. But this feels like the type of signing that anyone can fit around. And so it gives you that flexibility to then figure out those other moves around them. And Inter Miami hadn't really done anything big on the field since the end of last season. So this is your big move to kind of start to reset the process.
Guy that can win 50-50s, good in the tackle, has some ability to go forward with the ball, according to all the scouting reports. Nice signing here for Chris Henderson. All right, speaking of Chris Henderson, he was a player at UCLA in the late 80s, early 90s. So was Kobe Jones. They were on the same team together. We chatted with Kobe earlier about his career, about the anti-racism project, about race in soccer. Take a listen. Great interview. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field with a legend, with Kobe Jones. Happy to have you here, Kobe. I already want that jersey that I saw you guys wearing, modeling for the Galaxy. I'm practically begging for it at this point. What a throwback. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. And I'm sure the Galaxy and myself, we might be able to do something for you. You know, you might have a little bit of trouble when you're wearing it in the streets over there.
That thing sold out fast, Kobe. I don't even know if you can get one at this point.
Trust me, I have one.
I have an original as well. Don't worry about this new blood stuff. We got the real thing. All right, let's jump into this, Kobe. We had an amazing conversation with Tony Sonne, and he's the first. We're trying to get back into MLS story time. And my gosh, the career that you've had and continue to have, there are stories. So I want to start with something that I think we can all relate to, which is where, how, when did you fall in love with this game? What is sort of that moment in your life where it just clicked for you and you said, this is me. This is what I love.
Wow, that's an interesting one. I don't think I've been asked that in that way before. As far as falling in love with the game, I'd say that at a young age, when I was 5 years old and just playing, you know, I think there's a sense of freedom when you're a kid. I think any adult can look back, you know, and just go, you know what? It was nice just to go out and just kick the ball. It wasn't so much about winning and losing. It was being with your friends. It was having fun. You know, the winning, yeah, that was great. But even the losing at times, it sucked. But you know what? It wasn't the end all and be all because, you know, we're having pizza afterwards. You know, those were the times that were some of the best, you know, of my life. And I loved running. You know, I mean, the two things that I did pretty much my whole life growing up was soccer and track. You know, so that kind of tells you, I just loved running. And so being out on a field, chasing a ball down, kicking the ball with my friends, you know, so I'd say an early age of like 5 years old is when I kind of figured out that I just love playing soccer. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of people throughout my career always said that I felt that I was always smiling and laughing when I played the game. It's because I was having fun. You know, I had a good time being out there.
What was the name of your first team? Your first official team. I want to say I was on an AYSO team. They had the like template jerseys. You know what I mean? They had the same jersey, different colors. I think ours was yellow pants and a maroon top. And I think we were the Eagles. I'm curious what yours was.
That's funny. I think mine was yellow and like a green. So kind of similar to the Galaxy colors, which is funny. Wow. The Galaxy colors. And I think we were... Funny enough, I think we were like the Hawks or something like that along those lines. I think it's interesting that it tells you how far away I am from those days as compared to you, because you can still remember it. You know,
like what? I mean, this might just be me remembering pictures. You know what I mean? It might not be a full memory. It might not be a full memory. I have to fact check Wikipedia, and I saw that you went to UCLA not on a scholarship. So. Is that right? And tell me how you got to UCLA and what it represented in your mind as a California kid.
Okay. We'd have to jump back a little bit, just talking about, you know, the soccer in general. I never planned to play soccer, you know, past high school. You know, I just thought, okay, this is, you know, fun stuff. This is something I'm doing. I'm going to go to college and do whatever. So I applied to all the schools and everything, got into the schools that I wanted to go. I applied to all the UC systems. For soccer, like for UCLA, you know, I had to walk on there as far as I wasn't given anything. I wasn't going to, you know, they weren't going to give me a whole lot. So I had to prove myself. And I remember those first days of going in there and trying to prove myself against all these guys, which, funny enough, if you look back, they talked about that year being the best recruiting class going to UCLA, because you had all these national athletes, you know, that were going there. And that's something that I had never done. I had never been on a made it past a district team or made it to the state team or anything like that. So it was, I guess, intimidating, you know, at the beginning. But I always remember my mom just saying, you know, just do your best, beat your best every single day and try to get better. And she helped me with that process. She helped me with the process of actually deciding on UCLA, you know, because at least UCLA had, you know, a somewhat of a known soccer team, and she knew I loved soccer. So she said, well, you go to UCLA, you know, you've been accepted there, go there and, you know, give it a shot with soccer because you enjoy it.
So we've both worked with Ziggy Schmidt and talked to him about the UCLA days and the teams and what it was like. And, you look at the names. I mean, you mentioned the recruiting class. You look back now, you're talking about national teams, and not just U.S. national team players. Other countries, talking about EPL players, MLS legends, the whole thing. What was that group like? I mean, you went from that to playing national team and professional. How high a level was those UCLA trainings? How high a level was the college game at the time?
Yeah, that's interesting, right? There's no academies. There was no other route. It was, you know, high school, college, you know, and, well, at that time, you're done. So there's nothing else. So college was very high, where you had all the top colleges considered, I guess you would say today, as being like national teams. Because I looked at my year and the year after me, you know, there's a lot of names that people would recognize. You know, my year, there was the Mike Lappers, the Sam George, the Joe Max Moores, Joe Max Moore is like the year after, but just like Joe Max Moore year after, Chris Henderson year after, John Henderson, Brad Friedel. You know, this is all within that 4-year time frame. A lot of the players, you know, that I played with. So we were consistently pushing each other, you know, on the field and off the field. And I have to give Ziggy so much credit. You know, he had an eye for young talent and seeing the possibilities in players, you know, and that was something special that he had, and he brought a fantastic group and was up and continued to recruit year after year some top talent.
I was looking at 1990. You guys got a little championship there. A lot of Kobe Jones in those recaps, but you beat Rutgers in the final. Is that a Rutgers thing? I saw Lino, who MLS insiders will know a little bit about Lino on there. I saw Lino on that Rutgers team. Was that an Alexi Lawless Rutgers team too?
Yes, it was. Yes. Lino was on there. Alexi Lawless. Quite a few, you know, names from the past and from today still involved within the game, which is great to see. But yeah, that was the highlight of the college days, you know, winning that championship. Alexi a little bit, you know.
I was going to say, at the MLS events, when we used to go to those, I mean, that had to be like at the bar banter for decades. You had to lord over that.
Yeah, of course. You have to. You know, anything happens, anything good, you know, she's all, yeah, I still got that ring. You know? Banter is important. You got to have a little banter.
Let's turn a little bit towards sort of the time after that. Because I always think about in your career, like there is that middle ground. You said it. There was nowhere to go for a while, and you kind of had to make your way until you got to the Galaxy. I mean, part of that is with the national team building up to 94, and we know how much work went into that, how much time you guys spent together. But then after that, you have Coventry City. I have never really heard like Kobe Jones Coventry City stories. I've seen the photos. I've seen, you know, the light blue, and you always hear about it and you think about it. But I was doing some research last night, and I was like, I don't think I've ever heard Kobe talk about this. So tell me how that happened. How did you get to Coventry City? What was the experience like? Where were you in your life? What was the club, the league? What was it all like?
Yeah, well, there was no league here. So I guess, you know, after the World Cup, it was a big decision for a variety of players, coaches, the U.S. soccer staff, figuring, okay, the World Cup has happened. Now there's going to be a little bit of a delay before the league starts. How do we make sure that our players are still competing and in top form so that they are in good shape, you know, and when the league comes back? So U.S. soccer was like, okay, we need to find a way to place our players, you know, where we can and get them playing time on teams. And they had to advocate for us, you know. So it was about during those times after the World Cup and the friendly matches of bringing in coaches and bringing in teams, and they're looking at all the different players and trying to figure out, you know, who's going to go where. The opportunities for me at that time were looking at teams in Mexico and teams in England. And I guess it was off of the game, I believe we played England at Wembley, and I came in as a sub like the last 20 minutes or so. And I had a good run down the line and beat a couple of players, you know, and they got the cross in. And I heard that was the selling factor where Coventry wanted to bring me in with my speed as a winger. So I ended up going there. Now, I'll tell you just a quick story before you can ask more questions about Coventry, is I thought it was very interesting that when I finally got there, and, you know, it was very different, you know, going from Los Angeles, you know, to Coventry City, where I remember the second or third night that I was actually there, I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to give a walk through the town. And I was able to walk through the whole city of Coventry in under 30 minutes. You know, so okay, it's a little different than LA, you know, a little bit smaller, more intimate, you know, but that was kind of like one of the first experiences where I was just like, wow, this is it's a bit of a change.
So what was the soccer like? Sorry, Dave.
The soccer was very direct. The soccer, you know, it was a lot of ball going over my head, a lot of this for me, you know, in the midfield, you know, and running back and forth, you know, chasing the ball, you know. The one good thing is I had Roy Wagerly there as well. So he was a good person to lean on, you know, at the time. And he actually helped me kind of integrate a little bit. He actually found an apartment that was right next door. So we were like neighbors, and that helped. I can't even imagine what it would have been like if I was by myself. That's why I think a lot of people have to give a lot of credit, you know, to these players that travel overseas, even though now it's a little different. I mean, you probably have a whole team, you know, going with you, with handlers, you know, and all this type of stuff. But back then it was like, okay, plop you down, see you later. You know, so it's definitely.
So we want to take you to the next step of your, you know, career and what happened, which is everyone talks about the 94 World Cup and the huge moment that it was, and then World Cups after that. And somehow the 95 Copa America sort of slips underneath, even though it's arguably the greatest performance in U.S. national team history. Take us into that tournament and where the group was and what you remember from those experiences, and then we'll get into Vasco da Gama a little after.
The beginning was rough, Kobe. I mean, I was reading about it again last night. The beginning was a little rough. You guys didn't know you were going to play.
Really? What did you hear?
I was reading that you guys were on the plane saying, hey, U.S. soccer, this is not working for us.
Yeah, look. Players and you have to think of it at this time, ownership at that time was U.S. soccer. It wasn't like a club team or anything like that, but players to management, it can get testy at times. And that's, once again, was a testy situation. You know, as you see the women's team having issues now, we had a lot of issues back then, you know, with U.S. soccer, and it was a battle. I'll tell you, you know, side note, I tell you, someone could do a fantastic 30 for 30 on that 95. I mean, there are stories in there you wouldn't believe. I can't get into just everything that happened. I'm telling you, I'm willing to produce it. How's that? But there was a lot of talk because we were going through, okay, we wanted to get paid more. We wanted to get more value, especially after the 94 World Cup. Going into 95, we're doing another tournament representing the U.S. How can we get value, you know, for ourselves as players? And there was a lot of talk on the plane that we weren't going to play. There was a lot of talk. Look, what's interesting, during this tournament, like you said, Andrew, was arguably one of the best performers. Was it Andrew said it? Arguably
the best performer. That's all, Dave.
Okay.
All right. Arguably okay. The best performance. My apologies. I was just so excited someone remembered it. So this performance was special, right? But the off the field was probably one of the most contentious times in U.S. soccer and men's national teams history. You know, we had meetings constantly, you know, amongst ourselves, with calling back to Chicago from Paysandu in Uruguay. We were, you know, there were meetings where a lot of words were spoken, you know, words that I can't say here, you know, and we also had situation where there were threats of striking, you know, of just not playing, you know, and we actually didn't go to a training session at one point. You know, so, I mean, imagine that in the middle of a tournament. And you have to remember, I mean, you're talking about the Copa America, oldest tournament beyond the World Cup. So imagine during the World Cup, a national team saying, yeah, we're not going to train. You know, that's how intense it was, you know, but finally, after all the hardship and everything, things came together.
So where did the performances come from? With all that going on, to then challenge against some of the best teams in the world and perform in a way that maybe the national team never has?
I think the one thing that when you are have a negative focus somewhere else, you become tighter, you know, because you have to in order to survive. And I think our group became so tight and had to believe and lean on each other so much that that transferred over to the field, you know, and we played some of our best games. And as you talk about performances out right now, if you ask any of those players, if they can remember it, and they'll say who had probably the best tournament and played out of their mind, where I saw him doing things that I just could not believe, was Paul Calgary. He was playing like a sweeper, center back type situation. And I can remember against Argentina, two players charging down on top of him just outside the 18 with no support. He just did like a pullback back through his legs. Both of the players fly by and hits a 30-yard ball right onto the foot of somebody. I mean, it was amazing. I was like, when did he become this type of player? You know, he was playing out of his mind. But Paul Calgary, he was something special. And those types of performances weren't out of the ordinary. You know, everybody stepped up and played at another level. And I truly believe it was because we became more tight-knit and close-knit.
You had a little edge. How would you describe the Eric Winalda Diego Simeone interaction, let's say, pregame in the tunnel? I've read some different descriptions of it. Is that a Donnybrook? Is it a shoving match? Is there a brawl in there? How serious was that?
I didn't catch all of it, you know, to tell you the truth. I've heard the stories as well. I mean, it was like a knockdown, dragdown, throwdown. But, you know, all those things, you know, are – I guess just part of the situation. You know, we were intense. You know, the players there in Argentina, they were intense. You know, I look at that game just in and of itself as probably one of the best performances in U.S. soccer history. You know, just playing against Argentina, a team that was probably one of the favorites and just had so much talent, you know, but it didn't faze us for some reason, you know, to tell you the truth. And I think that was you know, that 3-0, I'll tell you this, that 3-0, they still talk about that today in Argentina. I still get, you know, people hitting me up online, you know, from Uruguay and Argentina just go, oh, yeah, I remember that game. That was amazing. You know, so it's really, I guess, I would like to see it more, I guess, more attention brought to it here in the United States to have an understanding of how important that game was.
Hey, man, let's celebrate it. And while we're celebrating it, everybody listening right now, go watch the highlights. There's always joy in watching those old school highlights back in 95 to see us beat Argentina that way. Incredible. And I got to fact check one more thing, man. I read last night, I was staying up late, just digging deep here, that Diego Maradona came down and congratulated you guys afterwards. Is that myth? Is that real?
I say it's real.
Then it is.
I say, man. It's real, and it is real.
Okay.
So we're gonna. It becomes myth, and myth becomes legend, right? You know, whatever.
And there you go. That's the opening of the 30 for 30. This is how Kobe sets it up by himself. But you mentioned you go, you play England, then you get a contract with Coventry. Did you go down to Copa America with no idea what was next, and then Vasco da Gama sees you there and brings you in?
Yeah, this was the I had no idea, you know, what was going on at that point. I mean, there was the thought of, okay, the league is going to be starting up, you know, soon. So what can we do in the interim? You know, and I was ready to, you know, stay here, train, you know, and just be prepped within the U.S. if necessary. But the Vasco deal, you know, came into effect where I ended up going down to Vasco, you know, for the time being when that interim period, which wasn't that long, 7-8 months, something like that, along those lines. So that was an experience of itself. I did go down knowing that it wasn't going to be permanent, that was just the, like I said, the interim, that I would be coming back to MLS.
What was that experience like? I mean, that's a weird experience, it feels like to me, to know that it's going to be temporary, to come into a different footballing soccer culture. Sorry, I'm having the Euro snubs rub off on me there. Into a different soccer culture. Like, how did you adapt to that? You mentioned the adaptation process in Coventry. I mean, you don't have an American next door at Vasco, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was definitely difficult, but I'll tell you this, it was much easier. You know, you're down at Vasco. I'm living on the beach in Rio. You know, yeah. You know, I walk out through the apartment building, and the beach is right there. It was a very welcoming, you know, cultural difference as compared to England, where, you know, in England, I felt like the teammates in England, it was that, like you said, the Euro snopping, it was that English, that vibe of just like, what's this American, you know, doing here, that I had to work to get beyond that, where I'm sure it was probably somewhat like that in Brazil. It was just more welcoming overall, where I never got that. Now, maybe that's because I couldn't speak Portuguese at the time, so I didn't hear a lot of the stuff, but who knows? But I still had a much better time. I just tell you, at the end of the day, you know, after practice, and you come home and you have an apartment that's overlooking Copacabana Beach, you know, what could possibly be wrong, right?
That's a welcoming culture.
That is absolutely the dream. That's the one place I didn't get to in that World Cup. Didn't get to Rio, and it still haunts me to this day how that could not have happened. Of course, this was all building up to one place for you, which is the Galaxy being in Southern California, and then obviously we know the rest of that story. Take me back to that first Galaxy team, and let's just go straight back to that game. You told us before we jumped on here that there are stories around April 13th, 1996. We are going to talk to Gio Savarese in a little bit. He had a role to play as a member of the Metro Stars. You had a role to play, a goal to score, as a member of the Galaxy. You told us before we got on here that there are untold stories that people need to hear. Let's hear them, man. I want to hear them.
Yeah, look, some have been told. I'm not sure everybody's heard them, but I would always love to repeat them because they are so fantastic. I think one of the stories that goes beyond before the game is that, you know, talking to the general manager and the owner, and they were thinking, okay, you know, we got this game coming. Look, they weren't the most positive as far as the expectations. Let's put it that way, where there was the thought process of like, yeah, I can specifically remember talking and like, what do we expect? How many are going to be there? This is probably like 3 or 4 days out, just saying, oh, well, we might get like 10,000 to the game. We're going to, you know, put tarps all over the top to make it feel like it's more intimate, you know, and they're trying to pull that whole thing. And we're just like, okay, well, we'll get like 10,000 to the game. I remember that whole week, every single day after training, probably doing like 2 or 3 interviews, you know, if it was driving to a radio station, driving to do an appearance, you know, these are the things that you had to do where your training ends at like 2, and then you're probably out and about for like another 2 or 3 hours to promote. And so we were doing all this, and then come to find out game day, you know, game day for us was driving to the hotel, having a team meal around noon, staying at the hotel for a couple hours, just meetings, then rest, and then taking the tram from the hotel down to the stadium. And I remember there was a lot of talk amongst the staff, you know, and they were just kind of like going back and forth. And I'm like, what is going on? And they said, well, there's a few more people than what we expected. And I'm like, really? How much? I don't know. They're just telling us to expect more. So I remember coming down, you know, if you know how the Rose Bowl is, it's in that valley, right? And I remember turning the corner where we're just like, okay, we might get like 15 or 20. And I remember, look, I've been to UCLA, USC football games, you know, and a variety of different things at the Rose Bowl, and coming down into that valley and looking, just going like, I see 10 to 15 just at the front of the stadium, you know? It was absolutely just smashed in with people. And we went through this whole crowd, and people are banging on the window, and you could just tell the excitement of everybody loving the fact that there was a soccer team in Los Angeles. And one of the things that I have to get across to people is, look, we ended up with 67,000 people, you know, coming to the game. 10,000 were expected. And from the final whistle, and I know I'm jumping beyond a little bit, but at the final whistle, the story is that there were still people in line in traffic on the freeway trying to get to the game. So imagine that. I mean, it blew away expectations that they were so unprepared because they thought 10,000 and all of a sudden 60 some thousand show up. They didn't have the proper police, the proper security, everything. Also, during the game, when those tarps, those got ripped off 15 minutes into the match. You know, the fans weren't having it. We're not sitting up here. They ripped them and came down. It was great. It was a moment. I loved it.
So we're going to ask Gio about the other side and the losing side when he comes on. And we want to ask you more about this, and this is why we could have you on for 2 hours. But I want to give you some time here before Weeby gets into 90 more questions about OG Galaxy. About we had Tony Sane on, and we talked to him about the Sane Foundation and what they're doing. And I know you're working with him on an anti-racism movement and a program through his foundation a little bit. And we want you to tell, you know, the listeners what that is.
Yeah, that's the common goal, you know, and there's quite a few people that are involved. Tony Sinna's foundation, Angel City Football Club, that I'm a part owner. I'm involved with it as well. And it's pretty simple, right? It's the name that says it all. We all have a common goal, and it's about trying to stop racism, you know, and using the power of soccer and sport to really bring that about. And I like to put this, that we can all do it in our own way. You know, and if you have a collective coming together to do it, that gives more power. But everybody's working in their own way to find ways to break down the barriers, start conversations, and really kind of confront racism. Because it does concern me when I do hear people say, like, oh, we're talking about this too much, and I've heard enough of this and stuff. It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It can shift. It can move to different levels as far as racism is concerned, but it hasn't been snuffed out. So until that happens, and who knows how long that's going to be, I'm going to continue along that project of trying to make sure that I'm part of the solution to trying to fight racism.
I think that's definitely the convenient and privileged attitude, right? It's like, we don't want to talk about it. I mean, that can't be what we do. That just can't be it. Action was the big buzzword that I saw yesterday and kind of this rollout for the anti-racism project. And I want to help both ourselves and our listeners understand, in your opinion right now, Kobe, what is the right action to be taken? And this goes from individual levels, you know, us, fans in the stadiums, people that have their kids in soccer, people that are just going about living their lives, all the way up to the organizational side of federations and leagues and this entire sort of governing body that we're under in this game. What action do you think needs to be taken?
Well, look, that's a wide range of people that we're talking about, right? So I guess in a generality of it, I would say is if we can acknowledge it, that's the first step. And then it's about making sure if you see it, that you do something about it. I like that philosophy that just saying, okay, I'm against it, you know, isn't enough. It's actually taking actions. And look, I don't expect everyone to constantly, you know, be doing something, but I think it's important if we can say, okay, if you recognize it and you do see something, that you actually do something about it instead of walking by and just going like, okay, well, that's somebody else's problem. I think it needs to be actionable items. If we can do that at every single level, if we can do it at a youth level, if we see it within the game, if we see it at the adult level, if we see it at the professional level, you know, these are things that we can do. You know, for myself, you know, I'm looking to try to stay active in this space. I'm trying to advocate, you know, for others. I think that's one big part too, that if we can advocate for people to be in positions where they can help make the decisions that we tend to think are the correct ones, I think that helps. And advocating is tough. You know, I think people have to realize advocating is tough because you're putting your reputation on the line too, you know, for somebody. So you have to know them, you have to trust them. But advocating for someone that maybe doesn't look like you, that maybe comes from a different background than you, I think is important. And just that in and of itself will force people to go outside of their comfort zones and what they're used to, you know, to actually deal with other people. And that's extremely important.
We heard Tony talk about a little bit that he thinks he hasn't gotten the opportunities that his resume, that his abilities deserve. And we've heard that from a number of players who have retired from this league and said, I haven't got the same opportunities as others. Have you felt that in your own career? And when you talk to young guys, and I'm sure that you have a network around the league, how do you talk about that aspect of things, of representation, of finding that advocacy, but then getting it over the line and getting those people in positions to make decisions and make change?
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely an issue there, and the numbers say it all. You know, everyone likes to talk about the numbers, but you can look at 25 years of MLS and you can see just the lack of diversity at the higher levels in the decision-making positions. And you know, that's the way I like to look at it, because those are the positions that everyone wants to get to, right? Those are the positions that have an effect on the league in the future. And I think there is starting to be some recognition of that fact. You know, at 25 years, you see the amount of, you know, African-American coaches, or just saying black coaches, you know, that, and there is a difference there, you know, as well, mm-hmm. that we have to understand. And the 25 years, we see how the league has changed on the field. And we see, especially with the Black Players for Change, we see the amount of black players within this league, but we don't see that transition or the same look, you know, in the management, you know, in the VPs, or what do they call it? The E-suites, you know, the executive mm-hmm. level suite, mm-hmm. you know, that's not there. Now, I hope that tends to change and that starts to change for the future. But I also argue that it needs to be actively put in place, you know, and not just like, okay, well, we're starting to change now, and watch as these players come through into the future, they'll be able to go into these positions. No, I think this needs to be done now, because we're in a position where people of color, people with underserved communities, all this type of thing, haven't had the opportunities because there haven't been those relationships. You know, people, yeah. What we've seen is people are, and this is what I say, not just with MLS, but with NFL and everything. And there's a reason behind it, because people tend to work with people that they know and that they're comfortable with. And if there is no, and I'll say this specifically, if there's no black person that is comfortable with, that has his group that he's able to pick from, then it's very unlikely that you're going to see a quick influx of black people, you know, going into those positions, you know, because people tend to pick from the groups that they're usually with, you know. So that's the kind of the way that I'm looking at this, is like, okay, how can we get this? How can we actively start making some type of change at the higher levels and kind of, you know, give those opportunities more of a push for people that haven't had it, like a Tony Sinna, I think, is a perfect example.
What about
anti-racism projects?
Sorry,
I just wanted to make sure people knew how to talk about it and how to support it.
So we've talked to a lot of people over the last year, because now people are having this conversation, and you're mm-hmm. one of the faces of the game in this country. And it, you come up, and I'm sure you hear yourself all the time of, where was Kobe Jones's opportunity? You know, all the people who have built the game in this country, you are on that Mount Rushmore, that pedestal, and yet you've not run a team or been a head coach generally, you know, given that interim opportunity for a time. Is this something that you felt, or was that one not? Year? Yeah, exactly. Or is that not what you wanted to do with your career?
I feel, to be honest, yeah, I have to feel that it was passed up. You know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that happened didn't go down the way I would have expected it or liked to. I have expressed my opinion on what I wanted to do, you know, within the game. But we'll see. Look, it's not something that I am letting die. You know, I continue to work towards, you know, trying to find a way to be more involved, you know, in the game, if it be it as I said, as you probably know, that, you know, as I'm running for the U.S. soccer vice president position, but also, you know, within MLS and the clubs and the organizations. And, you know, I'm still working there to try to find ways to continue to be involved, you know, within the sport. You know, that's what it's about for me. And it's not just like a passing fancy. You know, this is what I've done for a living, you know, for my life. So it is important to me to continue to want to give back, but also be involved, you know, in the game. So yeah, even though the opportunities, I don't think the opportunities were there as I think they probably should have, you know, I'm going to continue to, you know, see where I can find a way.
Tell us about the stump speech here, or I guess give us the stump speech. Vice presidential candidate, man, this, you're on the trail. You're on the campaign trail right now.
Yeah, I'm at the tail end of the campaign trail, because the election is on Saturday. But I tell you, I'm I'm tired. You know, this has been 2.5 months of just, you know, it's nonstop. And you go, you work hard, and it's a consistent, you know, every single day. And there's no time frame put on it. You know, it's not 9 to 5. But, you know, when I talk about, you know, this run for myself and what I'm trying to do here, it truly is, you know, about representation, access, and the advocacy, you know, and that's what I think, you know, will help U.S. soccer. You know, if we're talking about it from the bottom up and from the top down, you know, we talk about that representation. I can't tell you, I might be going on a side note, I can't tell you a little bit of how I hear from players that are retiring now that talk about still to this day that they had a lack of representation and how important it was to them when they actually saw a Black coach that could relate to them, or a Black administrator or a Latino administrator. These things were important. And I think I can't stress enough how important that truly is. When we talk about representation, it's important. I look at myself and talk about the fact that growing up as a young Black player in Southern California, I didn't see a Black person in a decision-making position until I was in college, when I saw Clive Charles, you know, as the head coach up in Portland. Now imagine that. That's 18, 19 years old. I mean, now thankfully we're changing a little bit, that I hope that isn't the case, you know, now, but I still have heard some stories from some current players that it's still the case. Now, so for me, it's about representation, access, you know, and advocacy. So I want to increase access to the game in underserved communities, broaden the tent of U.S. soccer, you know, in every single way, reaching out to the unaffiliated groups, if it's Latino groups, Black groups, African groups, Asian groups, whatever, to bring more into the tent of U.S. soccer. And that in turn helps U.S. soccer, because it gives diversity, gives diversity of thought, you know, it gives diversity of gender, you know, all these different things that matter, diversity of experience. You know, these are all the things that matter that can help in solving problems, you know, and helps looking at problems in a different way, you know, in the future. And that's a general. I don't want to go too long with you.
Hey, man, that was stirring. That was stirring. You've
got my phone.
That, and it's definitely coming straight from the heart. That was I am riled up right now. Like, that sounds amazing. That sounds like a vision that we should all be getting behind. I hope this Saturday goes well for you, Kobe. I could have you here for 2 hours talking about U.S. soccer and everything else. And unfortunately, our producer says we can't.
The computer take down.
But I have to have one more, Anders. Let me have one more. Just one more question.
Yeah.
Take it back to those early Galaxy days. When we talked about the jersey and that first game, there's all these players that get so much love from those early days on those Galaxy teams. Mm-hmm. Who's somebody we don't think about but should celebrate more?
Ooh, Eduardo Hurtado. Now, I know some people may know him and say, oh, well, he was a big name, but I don't think he gets enough recognition for what he was doing back then. I mean, he had defenders bouncing off of him, if people want to go look at those videos. And for as big as he was, you know, the skill set, how deft he was with his feet was absolutely amazing. You know, I thought he was, he was the best striker in the league, you know, that year. I mean, everything that he was doing, he was dancing around people. You know, he was chipping goalkeepers inside the 18, where it was just like, are you kidding me? Yeah, so for me, I think Eduardo Hurtado needs a lot, El Tanque, as we called him, needs a lot more attention, you know, on his success. You know, another one that, you know, I always like to give, you know, those potential stars, you know, a little credit. I mean, he was a star then, but like I said, I don't think he gets enough credit now. But there's also like the other ones that you would say are like the workmen. But Harut Kerapetian, I thought was something special, you know, something special as well. Now, he had his ups and downs, but he had a left foot, man. And he could hit a shot like there's no tomorrow, you know. And he's one of those players that, you know, this could – had a temper, and he could fire up, and that temper could take him either way. Either it'll be a meltdown, or he'd just have this amazing explosion and have like 3 or 4 goals, you know, in like 10 minutes. So Harut Kerapetian was another one that I think deserves a lot more credit.
There you go. Get the Google machine going, folks. If you don't know those names off the top of your head, go get the grainy highlights. It's good stuff. And go watch that 95 Copa America win against Argentina, 3-0. Kobe Jones, a big part of that, a big part of our soccer history, the all-time cap leader for the U.S., running for VP. doing big things with the Common Goal as well as the Anti-Racism Project. Kobe, like I said, I would do this for 2 hours. Unfortunately, we can't. I know it's early out there for you. Thank you so much for sharing with us here today and just hanging out.
No problems, guys.
All right. Well, I guess we have about 2 hours in the future with Kobe Jones to get all the rest of the stories that we just were not able to jam in there. That is an interview that I know I really enjoyed. I hope you did as well at home, wherever you're listening to this. If you have people around the soccer world, North America, wherever it may be, connected back to MLS that you want us to chat with, that you want stories from, that you're just curious about their career, their life, let us know. 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com, at extra time on Twitter. Before we get to Gio Savarese and the Timbers, Doyle, I need your thoughts on this U.S. national team preliminary Olympic roster from Jason Kreis. A lot of names here. None of the names that we know are not going to be in this process, the European guys, but still a really, really deep group.
Yeah, a super deep group. I think the notable absence is Paxton Pomykal. He'd been on a couple of podcasts last month where he said he was back to full fitness and you know sort of expected to be ready for the start of the season. But I understand Jason Kreis deciding to go with someone without that injury history. That said, bear in mind that the final 20-man roster for CONCACAF qualifying does not have to come from this 48-man roster, that 48-man preliminary roster that was released. What could happen, though, is if you take the 20-man roster and then someone gets hurt, if you're going to bring an injury replacement, that has to come from the 48-man roster.
Oh,
so
bizarre.
As always, yeah, as always with CONCACAF, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of smoke and mirrors. But it's, like, again, even without the likes of Pulisic and Kenny and Adams and Dest, it is staggering how much more depth, but also like top level quality there is in this group compared to, honestly, compared to the last two groups combined. So it's, no matter who's there or who's not there, or who Jason Kreis picks or not, this team should qualify. And we've seen failures at the U23 level in 2016 and in 2012, and there would be no excuse for it this time. And I don't care who's hurt, and I don't care who's not being released by their clubs. Like, this team has to get it done.
Kobe Jones played in the Olympics. 92 in Barcelona, that had to be a fun time. So must have been living on the beach in Rio as a young man. That's neither here nor there. I'm still imagining what his life and career must have been like. Let's get to Gio Savarese. After that, the mailbag. Stick with us. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. Out to Portland to Gio Savarese. To Gio Savarese with an incredible beard. Profe, what's going on, man? How long's the beard been going? Give us an update on the facial hair situation.
Yeah, first of all, it's a pleasure to be with you guys again. And I can see it in two ways. I can say that it's very Portland, but also I can see this is how long I've been waiting for preseason to start. So it can be used for both.
I assume the Timbers have some sponsorship for beard care products, trimmers, gels, all that. So I'm sure Gio's got top of the class stuff going.
Nat Borchers on the care, right?
He's the expert, so but it's difficult to match him up. It's tough. It's been long. His beard growing for many years, I think.
Ask him. I think wax. I don't know. I can't do it. You two have this handled. I don't have that, but I hear wax is very important. Gio, tell us about the soccer side, man. It's back, and I know we've been waiting, and you've been waiting. My personal thing is I look at the calendar, I'm like, okay, preseason is starting, but then there's 50-something days until the first. It's still too much for me. Like, I can't wait.
If we haven't learned something from 2020, is to wait and to be patient and to manage whatever is thrown at us. So I think, this start in 2021 shouldn't come foreign for what we expected. But nevertheless, it's still very complicated to have to wait so long. But we're glad that we're already training. We're glad that we have the group in the facility. The excitement of the players is incredible. They feel that it's been an eternity for us to go back and start again. So it's been yesterday was a great day to have the team there and be able to train.
We will talk to you about the guys that are training. Maybe Sebastian Blanco is. I don't know. You tell me. Where is Sebastian? When do you think he can be back? When will he be available to you to impact the Portland Timbers?
Of course, Seba has been a big loss from last year. He was in a great year, playing very, very well. So it was difficult not to have him. But we know Seba. Seba is a fighter. He's someone that likes to break records, and he's doing really well. He's rehabbing the best possible way, and he's looking closer and closer. It's difficult to determine to say, you know, by this time he will be ready. We want to be also very cautious, because when he comes back, we want him to be fully healthy. So we are following the right steps, and our strength conditioning group is doing an amazing job to get him where we need to, you know, see him be. So I think soon he will be with us again.
So last year, Blanco gets hurt, and it's mid-season. And as you said, 2020 taught us you roll with the punches and everything. And we saw Diego Valeri step in very well to Blanco's role. But now with the chance to, as you said, you want to protect him a little going into a new season. Do you have other ideas of how you want your group to work, who you need to lean on, how you want to set up if Blanco or when Blanco is not available?
Definitely. I think you mentioned something very important. I think, you know, a team like us losing two DPs and still be very competitive, it was a proof that the roster is well built, and we have a very strong group, especially the mentality. So with that in mind, we are planning as we don't have Seba. We are planning to be strong without him, because if we only rely on, you know, our DPs, then the mentality is not right. But when he's back, that's going to be a moment in which we're going to have a player that is going to help us so much. But in the meantime, we have to stay, we have to trust in all the players. And our saying in the locker room is always that the strength is the group, and that's the reality.
When you prepare in this preseason, is there a difference for you with the urgency of CONCACAF Champions League? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember in preseasons past, messing around is not the right way to put it, but experimenting a little bit tactically, formationally, with personnel. Is there time to experiment right now? Or is this just, we've got to find the 11 that can get past Marathon, that can get past America or Olympia or whatever it is, so that we can make a run in this tournament?
Definitely there's a difference right now, because we, in the past, as you mentioned, we're preparing for the season in MLS, and we have time. So we change some things, we look at some players, but now we have a definite date in which we have two games that we have to win and we have to qualify. So there's no tomorrow. So we need to be very in tune with the work that we have to do. We want still everyone, all the players, to get to the right place, but there is a goal to arrive April 6th in the best possible situation.
You've been around this league, this region for a while. What does CCL mean to you?
Everyone is excited. The chance to participate beyond MLS is something that makes us very proud, because now we have the responsibility to also represent the United States and represent MLS outside our league. So definitely something very important for us. And we have a huge desire to try to be hopefully the first team that can win this tournament in this modern time. Some teams came close, but we have that hope, but it starts from the first match.
What does it take in CCL to just off the jump against competition you're not familiar with? Like, as you look at previous runs around Major League Soccer, as you imagine how a run might play out for the Portland Timbers, what's different about teams that succeed in this tournament versus those that just bow out?
In this format, which is different than last year, which it changes back again to traveling to Central America, it definitely needs players to be flexible and to adapt to things that maybe they haven't experienced before. In MLS, yes, you find that you have to travel long, you have to go to different climates. But when you go to Central America, you face other challenges that you need to be prepared. Grass very tall, water, heat, situations in which teams trying to manage everything possible to disrupt the match. So we need to be prepared, in all that. But the good thing is we have experienced players that have competed also that away, overseas. And I think that's going to be a very important factor for us.
I wanted to ask about two of those players. You've basically reset your fullback position, and we've heard you know, from everyone in your team talk about Bravo and the expectations there. And then Van Rinken's one of those guys who's played in CONCACAF before. What was the focus for those positions specifically, and how does this change the way your team can play?
Yeah, first of all, we lost two very important components on the left side, Farfán and Villafaña. It was something that mutually we felt that was the right thing. So we had to move forward with that situation and then open for Claudio Bravo to be able to come, a player that's been in the interest of many clubs in Europe, that has a great future, and we're very excited for him in what we saw also in Banfield. So I think he's going to be a player that we're going to help to adapt quickly, but it's going to give us a lot of quality. And on the other side, Van Rinken, as you said, the fact that he played in the CONCACAF Champions, that he knows the Mexican League, was a big factor for us as well.
I want to ask you about late in games, because I think about CCL and our experiences with it, and we always talk about the gut punch, and so often that gut punch comes late in games, and it makes sense. Early in the season for MLS teams, early competition, but if you look at the Timbers 2020, you guys were not a bad defensive team, but you did give up a good number of goals in the last 15 minutes of games. I think it's maybe the most in MLS in the final 15. How do you explain that? I'm sure that's something this offseason you've been digging into as a staff.
Yes, definitely. I think we have had a progress in a process from 2018 to arrive to where we wanted to be. And last year, I think we played some of our best soccer, for sure. But definitely what you mentioned is something that we had to keep in mind, because we gave up too many late goals. We saw the game against Dallas, a complete in-control match given away in the last second of the match. So all of us have to take responsibility, coaching staff, players, individuals, all to make sure that we work on what we need to work to make that better, because you cannot win tournaments if you concede goals at the last second. And it was proven in 2020. And that was the reason why we didn't make it to the final again.
Can I ask you something about... Oh, sorry, Dave, I didn't see it.
You go, Weeby.
All right, can I ask you about Diego Chara and Father Time? Is he affected by aging, do you think? Or is this like a, you know, like a fountain of youth situation? And if it is, how can the rest of us become a part of that?
Great question, because we always say the cliche of a good wine, red wine, you know, vintage is so much better. And I know that you guys talk so much about Wondolowski, which it is a proven truth that, you know, he can continue to score goals. Chara is just that type of player that he never looks like he ages. I think the more he goes forward, the more professional he becomes. He works so hard. He takes care of himself. He does everything possible to continue to go forward. And we see, I think we are going to continue to see even a better Chara in the next few years.
That is a scary prospect for every team in MLS, if that's even possible. We just came into this segment and we were talking about, for the U.S., Olympic qualifying. And that roster, the preliminary group, came out, and you're honored to have some players on there. And one of them is Jeremy Obobese, who was a big part of the win, and MLS is back. And for you, has done a lot of things, but a lot of different things, playing on the wing, playing at center forward, both wings. What do you see for him in 2021? And positionally, what is it that he can do for you and he needs to, you know, do to reach his top level?
The communication with Jebo has been very good. From 2018, we have set goals from the beginning and expectations. And every year he matches those expectations. We remember in 2018, I felt that in the final was a little bit too big for him, but we had a good conversation. The next year, he came back and looked completely different. Last year, 2020, he looked like even a better player, a more comfortable player, you know, that when he found himself in the box, he could score. We saw in the MLS back tournament. And his flexibility allows also to be able to play him in a lineup in which had either Nies Goda or Mora. So credit to him, out of the three, he's probably the most flexible player to be able to be on the field at the same time. Next year is going to be a Jebo that is have to go score more goals, that has to be more impactful. A Jebo that, you know, that can show even more growth. And hopefully that is going to solidify him on the national team, not only in the Olympic team, but hopefully in the main national team, which is, I think, somewhere that he needs to be. And I think he's a quality player to be part of it.
Jason Christ said that his, quote, my strong opinion, this is from Jason, is that he's a nine, that that's his best position. You have the luxury of being able to play him, you know, in a number of places. What do you think his best position is?
I have to be honest with you. I think he can play very well both. He's that intelligent. He's that versatile. Because if you go back to a few years ago in the national team, they were claiming as well that he was a winger. So now he's changed to his forward. So he played in the U-20s. I think, I don't remember what he was in Asia. I think when U.S. went to play the World Cup, he played as a winger. So I think he can perform both. So it's the quality that he has.
Let me ask you about Eric Williamson. Because the leap last year, it was special. He went from a guy that was just trying to push into your team to a guy that I have to imagine you didn't want to take off the field. How does that leap happen, and where did he improve the most to be the impactful player that he became?
There was never a question of talent with Eric. We knew that he was very talented. The question was work ethic. Sometimes we have players from young that go through the system because they're so good without having to work too hard. And I wanted to see him put in the work rate. And once he understood that, which was somewhere around March or April last year in our conversation during the quarantine, he came back different. His shoulders were not shifting up and down. His acceleration was determined to win balls. And then the quality just came out again, because that's never been a question. And that's why he became so steady last year, because he knew every game was important for him. And now the expectation is to be even better this year. And that's the next challenge for him.
I wish we were in preseason right now, Gio, just sitting around, spending another half hour talking about your team off the air. But that's not going to happen today. But I do have to end you with this, because we did have Kobe Jones on this show, and we asked him about April 13th, 1996. He scored a goal. Somebody else, who would it be? I don't know. Who else would have scored a goal in that game for the Metro Stars? My memory, I can't remember. Might have been you. Could have been you.
Maybe somewhere around the box. I think maybe something happened there.
Tell me about that day in your mind. What's your memory like?
It is. I feel that it was like yesterday, but I remember everything that happened even before, because we expected around 10,000 people in the stadium. Somebody said 20,000, and we were so excited, and we said this is going to be amazing. And when we show up, it was 70-something thousand. So we couldn't believe that we were part of, you know, the start of MLS, something that we were waiting so long to be part. Unfortunately, we lost 2-1, lucky LA Galaxy, which he had a lot of, you know, players that now are coaching in the league, which is exciting.
Did that Metro Stars team, Gio. So did that Metro Stars team.
Yeah, exactly. Then let's not keep, you know, some players out. But being part of the game, score a goal. It was a moment that I never forget, but not only the match, everything that happened before, it was just a special day for sure.
All right. Thank you, Gio. We appreciate your time today. We're looking forward to watching CCL with the Portland Timbers and seeing what you guys do in 2021. Good luck. Enjoy the training, man.
Thank you so much. All the best, guys. Take care.
All right, guys, let's finish it up here. Big thanks to Gio Savarese for joining us. A big season for the Timbers. The mailbag, 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com, at Extra Time on Twitter. Remember, we're putting that tweet out ahead of every single show on Monday and Thursday. One of us will jump in to answer those questions. Doyle, have we finished the contractual work to get you to do that today?
I had forgotten we were doing that. So what do you need me to do? You need me to go on Twitter and be mean to people? Is that what you want me to do?
Yeah. I mean, if that's how you interpret this job, that's fine.
Atlantic right now is basically the opposite.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I'm good cop. You be bad cop. So, you know, when it's my turn, I'm the good cop. You're the bad cop. At Extra Time, we put this out before every show. So Doyle will jump in and answer those questions that we don't get to here. And since it's a stuff show, we won't get to many. But Santiago Close wants to know why Matt Doyle hates Atlanta United. He says it's an honest question. We need more kindness in the world, Doyle. Do you think that you hate Atlanta United?
I do not. I think of all 27 teams in MLS in sort of the same neutral capacity. And Atlanta United fans have over the years taken that to mean that I hate them. Like last year, for example, when Joseph got hurt, I said, you guys are going to go into the tank. You guys are going to be really, really bad this year without Joseph. And they took that as hatred. Like, well, that's not hate. That's analysis.
Oh, boy. Let's end here with some Doyle Wiebe storylines that we joked about on the show and David and Skokie delivered on. I've got some favorites here. Doyle, do you have a favorite Doyle Wiebe storyline for 2021?
Well, honestly, the number two, which is what word will Wiebe mispronounce that sends Doyle over the edge? And then he lists a couple of words.
Okay, do you want me to try those out? You want me to try those?
Yeah.
Accoutrements. Yeah.
Okay, well, you're not supposed to pronounce the T. You're not supposed to pronounce the T at the end, but that was really well done, though. So okay. I'll give you sovereignty.
Sovereignty.
No, sovereignty.
Sovereignty. Oh, my God. I knew it was sovereignty, and I overthought it.
Those were not bad. Do you want to try the French word? Well, the French towns that he is.
No. I just want to point out that David and Skokie is right that what mixed metaphor I use and screw up will be one of the stars of the season. Will I try to hitch my star to someone's train, or will I try to count one chicken while there are two in the bush? We shall find out in 2021. I also liked the question of when Doyle and Goss would get me to join in on a reference to a musical. Last week, of course, it was Fiddler on the Roof. Will their persistence pay off? And which show would break my duck? I don't think this is going to happen.
I don't think it's getting Wiebe involved. I don't think Wiebe knows a musical, so I don't know that's a reference point we can hit for him.
I cannot be involved.
David, if you, like, all right, it's a few months from now, hopefully, and Broadway is back open, and Andrew is coming back to New York to visit, and you can take him to a Broadway show. Which show are you going to bring Andrew to in order to instill in him a love of the theater?
It would be The Color Purple with Cynthia Erivo, and she blows the doors off, and then you'd be like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
And I'd probably be a fan at that point. I like Broadway. I don't know it like you guys know it. All right, that's it for us. Big thanks to Kobe Jones. Big thanks to Gio Savarese. Hit us up. Check out Doyle in the Twitter comments. We will see you on the other side.